What if I told you that the reason you keep hitting the exact same wall in your career, or having that identical exhausting argument with your partner, isn't because you just lack willpower?
Right. Yeah. It's not a willpower gap at all.
I mean, what if secretly your brain is actually getting this like massive psychological payoff from just staying stuck?
It sounds totally counterintuitive, I know. Because, well, we like to think we're always driving for success or, resolution.
Yeah, we all want to be happy.
Exactly. But beneath the surface, there's this hidden architecture dictating what we do. And it actually prefers the safety of a familiar failure over the unpredictability of a brand new success.
Wow. Okay, so today we are going to completely dismantle that hidden architecture. Welcome to the Deets Dive.
So glad to be jumping into this.
Because, I mean, we all have that one universal, super frustrating experience, right? That unfixable problem in your life that simply refuses to be solved.
Oh, absolutely. The one that never goes away.
Yeah, you read the books, you change your routine, you try every single productivity hack, and literally nothing fixes it. It just keeps coming back.
Because you're fighting the wrong thing.
Exactly. So today's mission is to unpack this roughly 15-minute practice. It's from a framework called selfdriven.u, which actually adapts Steve Zaffron and Dave Logan's three laws of performance.
Right, which is just a phenomenal framework.
It really is. And our goal for you listening right now is to understand how to basically make your invisible barriers visible and ultimately make those stubborn old problems just disappear entirely.
Well, to do that, we have to start by establishing the foundation of this whole framework.
Lay it on us.
It's this concept called the default future.
The default future.
Yeah. Your default future is the outcome you secretly believe is actually going to happen. Like, it is the outcome you would bet your own money on if you were being brutally, uncomfortably honest with yourself.
Wait, so it's definitely not the future you want to happen?
Oh, not at all. No, it is not your goal. It's certainly not what's on your vision board,
Right.
right? It is the default. And the really fascinating psychological mechanism here is that you didn't choose this default future consciously.
It was just sort of handed to us.
Well, it was written by your past, really. It's a culmination of your old assumptions, your past fears, and all the historical evidence you've collected throughout your whole life.
So it's basically quietly running the show in the background.
Exactly. And without your conscious mind even noticing it, your nervous system drives you to act in the exact ways necessary to make that specific expected future come true.
Man, okay, if we have this default future running like a background app, just draining our battery, how do we actually pull up the code to reprogram it?
Right, that's the big question.
Because generally, I mean, we are pretty smart people. If there's a problem, we try to fix it. Why do our usual methods of problem solving fail so spectacularly here?
Well, they fail because of how we approach the fix,
What do you mean?
We usually attack complex problems by breaking them into smaller pieces. We try to solve them one at a time. We basically treat the symptoms.
Okay, right.
But when we do that, we leave the underlying context, like the invisible environment that is actually generating the problem, totally untouched.
Okay, let's unpack this. Give me a real-world example of that. What does treating the symptom actually look like?
Well, let's look at a classic corporate spiral, straight from the source material.
Sure.
Imagine a company is struggling financially, right? So the leadership decides to immediately cut department budgets to save money.
Makes sense on paper.
Right. But that is treating a symptom, the lack of cash. So what happens next? Because budgets are slashed and resources are scarce, employee morale just
Oh,
plummets.
I've been there. Yeah.
And because morale drops, output and innovation fall. And because output falls, the financial numbers get even worse the very next quarter.
So the problem just regrew.
Exactly. Stronger than before.
Yeah.
Because the context, the underlying culture of fear and scarcity was completely ignored.
I mean, it's like setting an airplane's autopilot to crash, but instead of actually reprogramming the computer, you just grab the steering yoke and fight it with all your physical strength.
Oh, that is a perfect analogy.
Like you are pulling back, your muscles are burning, you're sweating, and you might, I don't know, briefly change the angle of the descent. You feel like you're doing something.
Right, you're taking action.
But the machine is fundamentally programmed for the ground. You are still going down.
That is exactly it. The move isn't to find a better, stronger way to fight the yoke. You will just exhaust yourself doing that.
Right.
The move is to make the invisible autopilot, that
Yeah.
default future, visible, which brings us to the actual machinery of how this works.
The three laws, right.
Yes. broke it down into three laws. And like gravity, you know, these laws operate whether you notice them or not.
Okay, so law number one, lay it on me.
The first one falls under what this framework calls curious mode. And law number one is how a situation occurs to you drives what you do.
Okay, wait. Let's translate that a bit, because occurs sounds a little bit like a management consulting jargon.
Fair point, yeah.
When you say how a situation occurs to you, you mean our subjective translation of reality, right? Like our internal filter.
Precisely. Your internal subjective translation. It basically means your actions never fight how a situation shows up for you.
Interesting.
Your actions match your perception perfectly every single time.
Mm.
So the objective, cold, hard facts of a situation matter far less than your reading of those facts.
I mean, if we look at how two people can experience the exact same event, this makes complete sense.
Absolutely.
Say two project managers are dealing with a massively delayed product launch. The facts are identical. They are 6 weeks behind schedule.
Right. Identical facts.
But manager A sees a disastrous failure because their default future is, you know, we're going to get fired.
Yep.
So their actions will match that panic. They might hide data, blame their team, maybe micromanage everyone.
Exactly. And then manager B looks at the same 6 week delay and sees like a lucky opportunity to fix a critical bug before it hits the market.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Why? Because their default future is we are building the most reliable product in the industry.
Right. Their whole filter is different.
So their actions will match that. They will collaborate, speak openly with stakeholders, dig into the data. The facts are identical, but the occurring is totally different.
So for you, the listener, your very first move is realizing that you aren't seeing reality exactly as it is.
Not at all.
You are seeing an illusion of how it appears to you, completely colored by your past experiences and your expected future.
Perfectly said.
But if two people can look at the exact same delay and see two completely different realities, what is actually writing the code for those realities? Like, what constructs that illusion?
Well, that brings us to law number two, which operates in what they call caring mode.
Caring mode.
Law two states, how it occurs to you lives in language.
Language. But we aren't just talking about the words coming out of our mouths, are we?
No, not just spoken words. We are talking about the entire spectrum of communication.
Okay.
It's the words you say out loud, yes, but it is also your internal monologue. It's your tone of voice, your body language. It is even your silence.
Oh, totally.
Have you ever walked into a room and just known two people were having a bitter argument, even though no one was speaking?
Oh, without a doubt. The silence is incredibly loud in those moments. Mm. You can just feel the tension in the air.
That tension is language. It is communicating volumes. And the most dangerous language that runs your default future takes the form of what this framework calls a racket.
A racket, like a mafia shakedown. I feel like we need a concrete definition for that.
Well, it is remarkably similar to a shakedown and how it holds you hostage.
Really?
Yeah, racket is a persistent complaint paired with a fixed way of acting.
Okay, a complaint and an action.
Right. It's a complaint you have repeated to yourself and maybe to others for so long that your brain no longer even registers it as a complaint.
It just feels like reality.
Exactly. It just feels like a plain, undeniable truth about the universe.
Wait, I have to push back here.
Go for it.
If you're listening right now, you might be thinking, hold on a second. I don't have a racket. My boss really is just a toxic micromanager.
Sure.
Or my partner really is entirely disorganized. Like, why on earth would anyone actively maintain a miserable situation?
It's a fair question.
If it's a stuck situation, shouldn't we desperately want to be free of it?
This is definitely the most confronting part of the entire process, and it explains exactly why we stay stuck.
Okay, why?
We hold onto the racket because it has a payoff. You unknowingly keep the racket going because it's providing your ego with a massive psychological reward.
Wait, really? So we are essentially getting paid to be miserable. How does that even work?
Let's use your example. You have a complaint. My boss is a toxic micromanager who never listens to my ideas.
Right. Classic complaint.
And your fixed way of acting might be, you know, shutting down meetings, doing the bare minimum, never offering new strategies.
Yeah.
What is the payoff there? The payoff is that you get to be right.
Oh, wow.
You get to be the righteous, misunderstood genius. And even better, you get to avoid something scary.
Like what?
You don't have to risk putting your own innovative ideas on the table and having them fail. You are protected.
Wow. That is incredibly uncomfortable to admit. The payoff is safety. The payoff is avoiding vulnerability.
Yes. But here is the catch. The racket has a payoff, but it also comes with a hidden cost.
The cost.
The cost is what this complaint is quietly stealing from your life.
Okay.
In the boss example, the cost might be your career progression, or your daily joy, or your professional confidence.
Right, because you're just checked out.
Exactly. Whatever you resist persists. The very complaint you are fiercely defending is the exact thing keeping you locked in the cage.
I see. So how do we pick the lock? Like, how do we actually break the racket?
You have to find the leverage point. You basically map out the racket, identify the complaint, the fixed action, the payoff, and the cost.
Okay, get it all on paper.
And then you must just sit with that cost. You have to really look at what this racket is taking from you. The intimacy, the success, the peace of mind.
Until it hurts.
Until you reach a breaking point, yeah. You have to consciously decide that being right or being safe is simply no longer worth what you are losing.
Here is where it gets really, really fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Because once you identify that racket and decide the cost is way too high, human nature tempts us to immediately rush in and slap like a good vibes only sticker over it.
Oh, absolutely. The toxic positivity trap.
Right. Our instinct, and honestly, the instinct of the entire multi-billion dollar self-help industry, is to just start a gratitude journal, do some positive affirmations, and pivot right to everything is great.
Which is exactly what the source material explicitly warns you must avoid.
Really?
You cannot skip to the end. You must first create space.
Yeah.
This is the chill mode of the practice, and it completely flips traditional self-help on its head.
Because traditional advice is always about addition, right? Add a new morning routine. Add a new habit. Add a green smoothie.
Exactly. Adding, adding, adding. But this practice requires subtraction first. You cannot paint on a full canvas.
That makes a lot of sense.
If your canvas is covered in the thick, dark, wet paint of your old racket and your old grievances, throwing some bright yellow positive affirmations on top doesn't create a beautiful new picture.
No, it just makes a muddy, ugly, exhausting mess.
Precisely. You have to scrape the canvas clean.
But what does that actually look like in practice? How do you create that psychological space?
It is an unglamorous, quiet, and often deeply challenging step.
I bet.
To empty the canvas, you must complete something. You have to close the emotional or mental loop.
When you say complete, you don't mean just like checking a task off a to-do list, do you?
No. I mean you have to consciously give up the need to be right about that specific situation.
Oh, that's hard.
You might have to forgive someone who didn't apologize. You have to let an old grudge go, or simply declare internally that a matter is totally, finally finished.
Why is that so hard for us? Why do we fight tooth and nail against just letting something go?
Because of the sunk cost fallacy of our grievances.
The sunk cost fallacy.
Yeah, we have invested so much time and emotional energy into being angry or being a victim that it has become our armor. And taking off the armor feels incredibly vulnerable.
So for you listening, this means you can't just ignore the past and look to the future. You have to actively put the past down.
Right.
You have to literally say to yourself, I am no longer carrying this grievance. I am setting it down.
And that quiet step is the crucial bridge. Without this conscious act of clearing space, the final step rewriting your future is impossible.
Because the canvas isn't clean yet.
Exactly. If you don't clear the space, your new future will just be infected by the underlying context of the old one.
Okay, so let's assume we've done the hard work. We've noticed how our problem is occurring to us. We've named our racket and realized the payoff isn't worth the cost.
Yep, you did the hard part.
We've chilled out, scraped the canvas clean, let go of the need to be right. We have a blank slate.
A beautiful blank slate.
Now what? How do we actually write this new code for a new default future?
We return to the power of language. But a radically different kind of language.
Okay.
This is law number 3, which operates in constructive mode. And law 3 states, future-based language rewrites what's possible.
Let's define the difference here, because the framework draws a very sharp line between two types of language, right? Descriptive language and generative language.
Yes. Descriptive language is exactly what it sounds like. It reports on what has already happened.
Okay.
It just describes the current state of affairs, like saying, our budget is low, or my partner and I are fighting a lot.
It's basically just reading the weather report.
Right. It is highly useful for looking back or taking inventory of facts, but it is fundamentally useless for changing anything.
Because it's just repeating what's already there.
Exactly.
Yep.
Generative language, on the other hand, speaks a future into existence that literally did not exist a second ago.
I mean, the historical examples of generative language are massive.
Yeah.
The Declaration of America.
Yes, perfect example.
Before someone put pen to paper and declared it, it was just a disconnected collection of colonies. The generative language literally created a new reality that people could step into.
Right.
Or Martin Luther King Jr. saying, "I have a dream." He wasn't describing the reality of the present day. He was generating a new future for people to live into.
Absolutely.
But how does that actually work in the brain for an everyday person, like neurologically?
It works by giving your brain a brand new directive. Have you ever bought a red car and suddenly you see red cars everywhere on the highway?
All the time. You think everyone bought one on the same day.
Right.
Right.
But that is your reticular activating system at work. It filters out millions of pieces of data every second to show you what it thinks is important.
Okay.
When you use generative language, you are reprogramming your brain's search engine. You are telling your reticular activating system to stop filtering for evidence of failure and to start hunting for evidence of possibility.
Wow. So bringing this back down to earth, to the specific 15-minute practice for our listeners, when you are at this step, you don't write a wish.
No wishes.
You don't say, "I hope my career gets better." And you don't just describe the problem. You write a specific declaration.
And it must be in the present tense, spoken as if it is already actively underway.
What's the prompt?
The specific prompt is, "I am creating a future where..."
I'm creating a future where my team collaborates with total trust.
Perfect.
Or, "I am creating a future where money is a tool for freedom, not a source of panic."
Exactly, yes.
But I have to play devil's advocate here for a second. I've written plenty of nice-sounding sentences in journals that went absolutely nowhere. How do we prevent this from just being an empty diary entry?
Well, a declaration is only a diary entry if it stays on the page. The rule here is incredibly strict. A future only becomes real when you act from it.
Act from it. Okay.
So immediately after making your declaration, you must design a first move.
What kind of move are we talking about?
An action you will take within the next 24 hours. But here is the critical key. It must be microscopically small.
How small?
It has to be so undeniably small that not doing it would actually feel strange.
Wait, if I have a massive structural problem in my life, let's say my career has been stalled for 3 whole years.
Okay.
Sending one Slack message or, you know, updating one sentence on my LinkedIn profile feels like trying to empty the ocean with a teaspoon. How does a microscopic move actually rewrite a default future?
Because it isn't about volume. It is about structural alignment.
Structural alignment.
Yeah. The microscopic move anchors the generative language into physical reality.
Mm.
When you take even the tiniest action that aligns with the new future, you create a physical contradiction to your old default future.
Oh, I see.
You are proving to your nervous system that the new reality is active. If your new future is a collaborative team, asking a colleague for their input on a minor decision isn't just a Slack message.
What is it then?
It is the very first breath of a new environment.
It breaks the old pattern instantly. That's powerful. Real quick before we wrap up, I do want to add a practical detail for you about the self-driven.u tool itself.
Oh, yes. This is important.
If you're listening and thinking, mapping out my rackets, my secret payoffs, and all my petty grievances requires me to be brutally, almost embarrassingly honest, well, you are completely right.
You have to be.
But the tool is built specifically for that vulnerability. All of this work is saved locally on your own device. It is never sent to a cloud, never uploaded to some random server.
Which gives you peace of mind.
Right. You can export it as text when you're done or just clear it and start over. It's a totally safe space.
Which is absolutely vital because, I mean, you cannot dismantle a deep-seated racket if your brain is constantly worried about who might read your notes.
Mm-hmm.
Radical honesty is literally the only way to make the invisible visible.
So let's look at the whole journey we've mapped out today for you.
Let's do it.
We started with a problem that just wouldn't budge. We learned that we have to stop the exhausting piecemeal symptom management.
Stop treating the symptoms.
Right. We have to stop pulling back on the yoke and fighting the autopilot. Instead, we target the invisible context.
And we do that by recognizing how a situation occurs to us, first of all.
Yep.
Then, naming the racket that is holding us hostage, sitting with the cost until we finally surrender the payoff, scraping the canvas clean by completing the past.
Getting rid of those grievances.
Exactly. And finally, using generative language to declare a new reality.
When you go through that sequence, an entire cluster of old, stubborn problems can suddenly stop making sense and just disappear.
They just dissolve.
They simply no longer belong in the new future you've declared.
It completely shifts your paradigm. And, you know, it leaves us with an incredibly powerful thought to consider.
What's that?
Well, Since our default futures are built entirely from the descriptive language of our own past experiences, what might happen if you deliberately borrowed someone else's generative language to describe your most stubborn problem for just one single day?
Oh, wow. That is an amazing experiment. Borrowing a lens to shatter your own illusion.
Think about it. If you adopted the descriptive lens of someone you deeply admire, a mentor, an innovator, yeah, a historical figure, and looked at your unfixable problem through their eyes,
yeah,
how quickly might your impossible situation suddenly occur to you as a totally solvable puzzle?
If you look at it through their occurring, the facts don't change, but the reality completely does.
Exactly.
I love that. Well, that brings us to the end of today's deep dive. We highly encourage you to find that quiet 15 minutes today, sit down, and finally figure out what your default future is.
It's worth the 15 minutes.
It really is, because once you see the invisible barrier, that unfixable problem in your life that simply refuses to be solved, might just be ready to disappear. Talk to you next time.